Thank you. It's really a pleasure to be here this afternoon and talk to you about this exciting project that we're working on, indeed called the California Burden of Disease and Cost Engine. And we're thinking of it as the California implementation of something we're hoping to call the Community Burden of Disease Project, which would intentionally not limit it to California. What is it? It's an evolving engine of resources and code using open source tools, mostly R. It's designed to be shared and used by others. And our current focus is the interactive display of community-level cause-specific deaths with the global burden of disease groupings. It is visualizations and tables with curated data and measures which can be further presented, analyzed, and modeled. And it is a collaborative effort among various centers within the health department, with local health departments, with academics, with some others, and maybe that others could include CSTE or any of you individual states or jurisdictions that would like to partner with us. Why are we doing it? For health departments and community partners to examine condition and geographically granular disparities in order to gain insight, to focus interventions and resources, and to evaluate impact. This is sort of an overall big picture of the architecture of the system. It is evolving. All aspects of the project are evolving, but it involves data from various sources, standards from various sources, merging, cleaning, organizing, processing with various calculations and measures, and outputting and rendering in various formats. Some of our real specific current work is looking at California death data, along with population denominator data, which I note there, it's because we're using American Community Survey data rather than our own state's data, even though there's a lot of caveats, don't use these for denominators. We wanted to use them in order to have a platform that could work for any geographic entity in the country. We do have incorporated some socioeconomic data, some cost data, that's in progress, and then there's a number of other things that we think and hope will incorporate depending on the sort of demands and desires of our partners. We've been doing a lot on looking at the mapping of various, the condition mapping as well as other types of mapping, but as I said, we're currently using the global burden of disease mapping system for causes of death, but we also have some NCH mapping and other stuff built in, and we're doing geographic aggregation. And for our purposes right now, we're using something in California called the Medical Service Study Area, which is defined by another entity within the health department, but it's aggregations of census tracts into communities, generally recognizable communities within those counties, or in some cases, when they're very large counties, they may not literally be recognizable as communities, but they're large enough to have meaningful calculations done. And then we're working on the merging, the visualizations, and the calculations. Why are we focusing on deaths? There's good quality population-based data. There's a standard coding system, ICD-10. It is a definitive outcome, and it's linked to up and downstream determinants of health that all of us sort of focus on in public health. And there's different measures that we can apply to death data that give different windows into the magnitude and burden of problems. Looking at these three, for example, death rates, whether adjusted or crude, versus years of life lost, versus standard mortality ratios, all give a different picture into what's going on with particular conditions in your community. Our data philosophy is to focus on communities. You know, that is where the action is. That's where we believe the interventions can take place. We are including other strata, demographic strata, but in some sense feel maybe there's been an over-focus on some of those strata to the detriment of focusing on the communities themselves where, again, the actions can be taken. We want to provide data and tools that are not available elsewhere and leverage what others have done. And, you know, we've seen a lot of rich things at this meeting. There's a lot of people selling stuff that's really good. There's a lot of people that have built other things, a lot of open source stuff out there. So part of our struggle is what is the value added of our project? And we believe it's there, but it's something we need to continue to sort of struggle with. We want to provide as granular a data as possible, but consider instability and data de-identification issues, of course. And we're not doing it just for fun. We want to provide data that can make an impact. Technical philosophy is using R and R Shiny. We're doing it in a modular way, so the code is, well, it will be understandable. I'm not sure it is quite now, but it's getting there. And therefore can be reused and supported collaboratively. We have this concept of just information inputs from various sources, but including Excel files. We rely completely on teamwork. Have one, at least one team member here in the audience. And focusing on fun as well, because it seems like that helps us move forward expeditiously. This is one example of one of the tools I'm referring to. This is one tab of one Excel file that is a piece of information behind the system. And the this column is ICD-10 codes with things like commas and dashes saying, what does that represent with respect to the global burden of disease groupings? This column right here is the regular expression representation of those sets of codes. And that regular expression is a chunk of syntax that can be used in SAS directly, it can be used in SPSS, it can be used in R, it can be used in virtually any programming language to say, if I have any of these, then call it that. And it's also either call it this number or call it that character string, depending on what you're doing with it in the app. Thank you. And so it's an example of a piece of information. We have other pieces of information along the lines of life expectancy standards, standard populations, and we're building things along those lines to further the project. We also have a description of a standard input file. I mentioned that we have these things called medical service study areas, but the basic concept is that if you can list census tracts and list your communities next to those census tracts, the product will bring in that file. It will use R code to create the new shape files, aggregate the data according to those new geographies, use labels associated with those communities, and do some of the renderings that I'll show you in a second. So this is sort of a front page of the current version of the app where we're seeing years of life lost by these communities in California for a selected county for a selected condition. So there's a condition there that is the drop-down list that is populated by that other spreadsheet. So there's no, you don't see that anywhere in the code. The code just reads in that component of the spreadsheet. That's a static map that has utility for some things. There's some interactive sort of zoom-in maps that have utility for other things. And there's a number of kind of ranking type components that are live and that we're working on. But this is looking in the particular community, or in this case, the county, but it functions for the community as well. What are the leading causes of years of potential life lost? So not surprisingly, cardiovascular disease or malignant neoplasms in this case. But if you sort of click over on what you want it sorted by, if you were to sort by the standard mortality ratio, and it's not precisely that, but darn close, it's saying that in this particular community, they have a particularly high rate of deaths due to skin diseases. Is it real? Don't know. Is it important for that community? Don't know yet. Is it something they'd want to poke into? Probably. We also have a number of other sort of renderings that are in other apps that have been developed in conjunction with this project that we haven't yet incorporated into the main app, depending on who wants to use it for what. But we have some bivariate mapping functions. We have correlation scatterplot type functions, some more sophisticated density distribution functions, which isn't just for any audience, but for some audiences, it's really what you do need to help get an understanding of what's going on with the distribution of a particular characteristic, and a sort of set of bar charts here that looks at differences by race and ethnicity and does some statistical testing comparing those observations. So some of the things that are key on the roadmap are to add a life expectancy function, to incorporate some of the small area estimation that CSTE has done some wonderful work on, to incorporate a function that actually calculates the public health geocoding disparities measures, because remember, we're bringing in national data for population denominators and things like poverty status, so all that would be needed is the numerator file, in essence, to be able to get those same measures for a different entity. You didn't see any confidence intervals there yet, but adding uncertainty estimation for everything that's shown, or at least with a click, having it be available, is on the roadmap. And we're going to be developing some sort of white papers, very, very short, one or two pages that summarize what we've learned on a number of different topics, so that others can learn from those, and so that those that we can collaborate and contribute to those that learning together. There is a live version of it at that top URL. It is on the World Wide Web, and it is with fake data or synthetic data. It is based on real data, but because of certain aspects of the vetting process, we are not yet releasing the tool publicly. These other two apps are publicly available data in California that use some of the same thinking and some of the same technology. And those are sort of real data. And we've been maybe a little, I don't know what the right word is, a little ahead of ourselves, but we have posted everything on GitHub, even though some of it's kind of a mess. But it's been part of our learning process to use GitHub. And for some of our partners, they can improve some of the little pieces by having all the code there and the fake data. And it's eventually, we're going to use it to its full capacity of kind of push and pull to improve the operation of the project. We would love to find out from you, either during the question and answer or some other time, how you think this app might be useful to you. Might you be interested in participating on either our technical team or sort of a planning team? And if not, maybe if you could just look at it at some point and give us some feedback, we would really we would love to get that, and would love to talk more in any case.
Thank you so much, Dr. Samuel. So we'll have a little. We have some time. I think we're supposed to be there at 3:30, right? We're just a little bit right before 3. Does anybody have any questions for any of our speakers? Nobody? I like when it gets to be all my questions. This is great because I have lots of them. The first is for, of course, Dr. Arizola. I thought it was really interesting about this $45,000 to $55,000 showing the most job satisfaction, but then also management. So it seemed like, so if you manage people, you're satisfied, and then if maybe, I'm assuming if you're making $45,000 to $55,000, you're new to the fields, you're still eager and excited. So is that the case? I mean, what are your thoughts on this? Because it just seems so weird, like there's this middle of the road, like we're far enough to where maybe we are a little bit more thick-skinned and crass, and we're not as satisfied, but we want to get to management, but the opportunities are there. Like, what are your thoughts on that?
So I guess I'll start first with the salary. And so I think it's, other studies have shown previously that when you go from like a basic minimum to like a little bit more, that it's more acceptable and there would be better satisfaction. But once you get past a certain point of making enough where you're meeting your basic needs, the level of salary, while it may influence your job satisfaction to an extent, it's not as much of a primary precursor to it. So that's just the other work that I've seen that I think explains some of that, which makes sense. You know, you're able to afford some more of those luxuries at first. As far as your question, remind me of your second part.
It was just, I just thought that it was interesting that there's this middle of the road people that are just kind of in the middle professionals. They're not management. I guess what I'm asking, is it because you think that they are further enough in their career that they want to get to management, and that's maybe why they're not satisfied, that there's not the opportunities for progress, for moving up?
Yeah, so I think some of those levels, their sources of satisfaction would be like serving as a preceptor to others, because it's more of those non-tangible, it's not your required duties that makes it satisfying. But as far as looking at why some categories are more satisfied than others, it really takes a look at, you know, they have more autonomy, they may have more control over their workload, so that perspective as well.
Okay, and then you said more African American. So have you broken this, or do you plan to break it down in the future to different types of epidemiology, like the focus areas as well in job satisfaction? Because I thought that was interesting too, and wondered what particular field it was in epi.
So we did not look at the subject areas by race. Once you start looking at, especially those with preceptors, its sample size went down drastically from like 681 to 174. And so to do those tests of statistical significance with that many categories wasn't stable.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Thank you. That's interesting. Does anybody else have any questions? Sure.
We absolutely do, and we would love to look at some of the other sources, like, for example, the communicable disease data could get in there. The same issues of vetting and you know, procedures and approvals would be required, but we would love to get those types of data. And, you know, you saw that word cost in there. There wasn't a whole lot yet in the cost side, but we are working with our folks that are involved with the hospital discharge data to look at both occurrences of those and costs associated. So our hope is that it sort of layers on multiple quality data sources to triangulate or look at different factors that relate to building the best picture. The one thing that sort of struggle with is that some of the conditions that we know are very burdensome to the population, we don't have great data sources for. I mean, one of the things like depression, that we know is a huge burden, it's hard to get those same kind of data sources, and particularly at that granular level. But I think we're going to explore or struggle with the issue of, for some things, just acknowledging that you have to go to a higher geographic level, and other things you can go to a lower geographic level.
Any questions? Yes. Could you please come up to the microphone if you don't mind, so we can all hear your question? And. Okay, and you guys hear? Okay.
Yeah, so okay. I just wanted to say that the summer of the presentation is outstanding. Are you looking at the data, like, for, do you define, like, in 5 years, or 10 years?
Yeah, there, I don't know if you actually noticed, but the date was not specified. And it's because we're trying to determine what's optimum in that regard, partly with regard to data confidentiality and stability. But the numbers that were in there, just so you know, were 2011 through 2015. And our intention is to focus in part on sets of 5-year intervals, if we're going to go down to those geographies, but presented to one of our kind of local data organizations in California and said, what about just moving averages or some kind of slime or smooth function that you don't need to do year by year, so we'll be exploring that as well. But time is absolutely a critical component. But I will also say that it was an exciting process to get the death data from within our partners within the health department, and the quality of the geocoding data for the older years we're sort of investigating right now. And so we're going to proceed using sort of a nimble development philosophy of get it up there and sort of, but subsequently try and make it better and better. But time will definitely be a critical factor.
So your medical service areas, I was just looking, they're quite large. They could be like 100,000 population, 75,000 population. Are you thinking of going down to smaller geographic scales, particularly in areas that aren't big cities?
Well, if only we could find some sort of geographic aggregation tool, then we could consider proceeding with this.
Yeah.
Which it was great, you know, talking to you some about this yesterday, and I think we would like to just explore that as a, using your tool or something like that to create other geographies. In a lot of the urban areas, they are still meaningful kind of growth communities.
Yeah, for Los Angeles, it would be great.
For LA, for Alameda County, for a lot of them.
But if you had a city of 100,000 and you had a poor neighborhood and a rich neighborhood.
Absolutely. So we're exploring different ones, and we are basically assuming and hoping that for our county partners, they're going to want to use the tool at the census tract level. There's no reason that they can't or shouldn't. Given that they'll be able to have the proper caveats about instability. The data de-identification won't be an issue in terms of it's their own data in a sense. They are the counties. But looking at something in between would be very exciting to find geographies. I mean, there are, this came up with one of the things yesterday, I guess, but some of the counties are very small themselves.
Loving, Texas is 89 people. That's the smallest county in the country.
We don't have like that, but we have a number there. And we sort of, you know, I think people, I don't, I've seen some faces from one of the other sessions, but this issue of statistical instability and data de-identification are so often merged, and they are just not, they converge because small numbers bring issues for both of those, but this magic 20,000 that has come up, or magic 20 for a denominator, a numerator, that is strictly based on statistical instability and has no basis in any evidence for data de-identification. So we're trying to find a balance there, and it's kind of one of the tools we like to do, but we can't do too much, but that issue of good logical rules for data de-identification, more so than the arbitrary rules that many of us, you know, have used. But yeah, we're excited to look at other levels of aggregation.
Any other questions? Anybody?
Will that presentation or a report based on it be available?
I'm planning to have one.
Any other questions? No. I actually have a question for Melissa then. So you talked about the different criteria to determine which conditions you were going to look at. What did you get that criteria from a certain area, or where did you, how did you come up with that criteria?
Our program managers have both been at the county for at least 10 years, so it's just their experience, a lot of it, and ones that they knew that they had in mind. So it was not really a literature search. It was just the primary driving force was the rule out rate.
Okay. And for the disease, we're choosing West Nile.
Oh, it was as well. It was just West Nile season.
Okay.
It was convenient. So yeah, since then we have done Lyme and CJD, and we haven't met to determine which one to do next.
Okay. What did you find with the other ones? See, that you were okay.
CJD we just launched like a month ago. So.
All right.
Yeah.
Thank you. Anybody have any questions?
Yeah, kind of follow up question there was a criteria of not of public health significance.
Yes.
And did that mean not of investigation significance? Because Creutzfeldt disease, you know,
so,
it happened to be bad count.
So.
Or all of them have significance, but they're not all. It's too late for a public health.
Like immediately reportable.
Is that
right? It's more. So yeah. Again, it's more specifically because measles and mumps were in there, and we just knew we didn't want to touch them because we didn't want to miss one case because they're so contagious. With CJD, we looked into the numbers, and we don't have the. Which one's the bad one? I'm totally blanking out. There's four different types of CJD, and we've never had the bad one. So. And we would spend like 2 months investigation times. You're having to wait for the autopsy to be done, to be sent off to the CJD testing lab. So we made a certain criteria that it's only looking to ones that are like profound, so the threat or pulse of the and the age part.
Yeah.
One other question regarding the study, that job satisfaction.
about the distribution of it or whatnot? Because it looked like some of those highly significant differences weren't very big, but they were due to reasonably large size numbers. And what is an important difference in that scale? Do you know? Or?
Yeah, and so it was created by Bowling Green State University a few years ago, and it really was able to say, like, each time you iterate or you implement this, it's going to vary based on the distribution of your data. So 75%, like where the mean median zone and the distribution was, 75% of that because for 34 or higher, and the cutoff for satisfied was 29. And so most people, you know, based on that distribution, a lot of people are satisfied with their job. They saw the folks for moments in that scale. The challenge is, like, okay, well, how that sample size of who aren't satisfied that even fall, you know, beyond the neutral zone with the actual not satisfied area. It's harder to classify them because the sample ended up being so small. So to better understand those that were not satisfied, didn't really come out in that the quantitative analysis, but it more came out of the quality.
But the comparisons were t-tests or something, right? They were on the quantitative variable. It wasn't the proportion satisfied. It was on the actual mean.
Yes.
Is that right? Was it t-test?
Yeah, it was
a t-test. The dichotomous outcome. So.
For the ones that, because it was a continuous variable, the GIP 4.
I have a question for Matthew Smith. You talked about ICAS and as well. You talked about the government office and acquiring nobody's response plan. Did you also share with the epidemiologists the data so they can see?
We bring it up. We have bi weekly meetings with the epidemiologists, and we throw it up on the screen and there's lots of discussion. So. But they know that the volume of calls is based on the disease du jour of, you know, right now it's Zika. That's the bulk of our calls right now. But yeah, we try to share it as much as possible, even with the commissioner's office. They're looking at it as a quantitative way to say, hey, is this something we can measure? We're doing what we're supposed to do within X amount of time. And I think when you start to put it on the graphical, we always had like an Excel spreadsheet, but when we get enough to do a graph, people in the commissioner's office are like, holy cow. Y'all are taking this many calls, but of course there was never any staff, additional staff being added, and so the admin staff, I think, were under the gun too, because the phone lines are just ringing and ringing, and our office, sometimes in surveillance, they ring, after four rings, they ring into surveillance, so our staff was like, holy cow, like, you know, we knew that it was bad, but until we started looking at it and, like, quantifying it, it brought a light to a lot of people that we needed additional resources, and so it allowed us to hire a contract Zika Epi, then her job is to really kind of help us with the calls, which helped ultimately bring our calls within what the governor wanted.
So in the fusion, did they want to look at the optimum time for the calls?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first part.
In the future, would you think there would be used to look at what would be the optimum time to respond to different calls? I ask that because people who work with clinical studies, the bean counters are always saying, well, it should be only 15 minutes that you should spend in the patient. And this tradition for treating patients, they say, no, I wish I had. Sometimes they need to quit because they say the bean counters want the course to be as short as possible. Do you know what the epidemiologist feelings are? Are they being told to make the course as quick or can they spend as much time as they want on one course?
Some do. That's why they were huge outliers. And measles. I think measles cost a lot of time sometimes. And then you're playing phone tag. So I think the optimal, I mean, if we were really doing poorly, I think somebody on high would be like, what the heck is going on in DPH? But the fact that we worked with them to set the goals, it wasn't just the governor's office saying, this is what you're going to do. They listened to the FE program manager say, you know, this is the volume, this is what we're seeing, this is doable. But, you know, of course, we set it a little bit higher and then they lowered it. But we still had a seat at the table to discuss what the goal was to get for the metric. But so far, so good.
Any other questions?
A question following up on this. I want to make sure that I understand who these calls are coming from. Is this is the general public calling?
Anybody and everybody they call 1-800 goes into MAVIS. and we have overnight epis that we now are putting in the overnight calls. So now we're able to see, because we never really paid attention to how many calls people are getting after 5 p.m. night and weekend. So now we're starting to look at that, and the program manager is like, well, you know, you're supposed to be answering these calls because you're on call and you're getting paid for it. So they're starting to look at it, I think, a little bit more.
Is there another avenue for people to contact you that's not telephone based?
Yes, our office also has an email, and so now we track email, because I think you look at our calls in the database, they're like, well, nothing's going on in surveillance, you know, maybe it's 50 calls, which is, it's okay, because we also have an on-call group in surveillance to deal with Maven-related issues or surveillance questions. But then we started putting up emails. We get roughly 600 emails a month.
Right.
From users and other data requests. And then we also have an EOR email for EOR questions, and those are in the 800 to 900. So I think the higher-ups finally realize, you know, it's not just the volume of calls, it's all the other stuff that comes into your office. And so we're trying to communicate that out so it can let people know that we do need more resources and that we're aiming a high burden of email control.
Do you put those emails into Maven as well then with the...
We can track from the email address that's specific for that, and we have categories that we, at the end of the month, my staff will quantify the emails and our on-call in that month report.
Any questions? Actually, I had a question, Scott. So the calls come in automated, but obviously a staff member has to come in and type all that out and put it in information.
It's brief information. It's like, and some people don't want to even give their information because they're like your government entity. So some calls are in as anonymous. And you just got a call. They'll say a mail call about Zika testing or something. So you only have to put in first name, last name, or anonymous, and the city, because we were trying to track where these calls are coming from. You click save, and then there's a question package where those variables are. And so then you just type in, you pick the disease. They'll say, I'm calling about bed bugs, or I'm calling about scabies. And then you type in a brief summary, you know, and you press save, and it goes into the workflow for the epi to triage. It's like an on-call system almost.
Okay, and then the epi, whenever they have the call, they put in more information about...
Yep, they say, yes, it's open, and it automatically date stamps, and they put in their name, and then they might put in a note, but a lot of times the drop-down says spoke to caller. They can say spoke to caller, give them the answer, say.
Okay, so that's what I was wondering about.
Yeah, it's very limited. Like, you have to pick some type of action. Did you speak to the caller? Did you leave a message? More information needed, whatever. And then you can also transfer calls between the groups.
Okay.
So sometimes they'll call and they'll say, I'm calling about Zika and I want data. It went to the epi because the admin said it's a Zika call. So the epi will change it to my program by saying Maven issues and concerns, and it flows into the workflow for our staff. And we have on-call staff that's monitoring.
Okay, so not a lot of time to have to type and stuff. It's just click, check out. Okay, cool.
As quickly as possible, because the calls are coming in pretty
yeah, quickly. It's a lot. That's what I was wondering. It would add it a lot to put that stuff in.
We try to be as minimal as possible on what we wanted to capture, and that's why it's all tied to automatic. That was one of those process implementations we made. The epi used to have to click the date and the time. And it used to drive me crazy when I did on call, because I was like, what's hanging the butt?
I need
to say when I say yes, I'm taking the call, I need the date and the time to auto-populate. So
yeah.
We updated that. We standardized the name. So all you have to just type in SC, and your name pops up, and you click enter, select a caller, say.
Okay.
So we streamlined it since 07, 08, 09, a couple different times.
Is there just one last question here? So is there any follow-up from the governor that physicians should be less of a response time since they're physicians calling? Has that been...
No, they don't.
It hasn't been brought up? Okay, I was just surprised by that. I thought there'd be like 5 minutes or something.
No, I went on the webpage this morning just to kind of see, and there's limited, there's list out what the metrics are, but there's limited reports on what's actually happening in some of the agencies. So ours goes to the commissioner's office, up to the secretariat, and I assume the secretariat is moving it over to the governor, but...
Okay. I'm from Texas. I just assumed that if the governor came out with that, it would be like, physicians, you need to respond in 5 minutes. Everybody else, 50.
Think that would be the case. The doctors, I mean, we don't triage doctors' calls any differently than the public. If the doctor says it's an immediate disease event, such as a measles, mumps, rubella, then most of the time if they say I need to speak to an epi right then, they don't go in the call log. They'll transfer it to what we call the epi of the day. And the epi of the day triages the more higher risk diseases or comments or questions.
Okay, so just general physician questions then make up a small percentage.
We're not tracking who's actually
Okay.
Interesting to start doing that. So.
Okay. Any other questions? I think somebody had their hand raised here in the back.
You know you're going to get the queue, and they're really good at explaining that, you know, there's lots of calls in, you know, in the queue, and we will get back to you within 15 minutes. That's the standard, and we try to do it within 15 minutes.
Okay, and so what if a physician is calling in to report something? Is there
yep,
okay,
that's for the EOD of the day. The EOD of the day.
They can do a warm transfer on that as well.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
And we have 2 to 3 EODs, Monday through Friday, and those rotate every day, and whatever you end up with is what you end up with, and they deal with all the immediate diseases, they end up with all the clusters and outbreaks.
Those are warm transfers.
Yeah.
It's not common. Okay.
Right then and there. Yeah. I mean, if somebody says, I need to feature that now, you're going to get transferred.
Any other questions? All right. Well, then, let's thank our speakers one last time. Thank you guys so much. Appreciate it. Thank you guys.